Thanksgiving. All right. I have learned a lot about myself over the last several years, decade or so. It's amazing how you really increase in self-awareness as you age. And once you hit like 22, 23 years old, it's amazing to me how you start to actually recognize trends and patterns about yourself that, quite frankly, you just didn't notice as a child. And one of those things that I've started to learn about myself is that I don't cry all that often. Now, you may be that kind of person. You may tear up literally all the time. It's not a statement of judgment on myself or a statement of judgment on you. I don't say that I don't cry enough or that I cry too much. It's just a statement of reality. For me to cry, it either needs to be an extreme situation, a level of high stress, a significant loss, or a movie that features an emotional moment between a father and a daughter. I don't know why that last one, that's a weird one for me, but it's something I've learned about myself. Again, I've become very self-aware. And that's almost literally every time. Armageddon, I bawled. The Patriot, I bawled. If there is some kind of emotional moment, I don't have a daughter. I don't know what it is, but that's just something I learned about myself. It's just, it is. So when I have moments that I look back on and in my memory, when I think about times in my life that I have cried, it tends to be because something significant is going on in my life. It tends to be because I've gone through something significant. And I remember one particular night in January of 2012. That I went through one of those things. And for me, this was a doozy because I had a critical choice to make that I wasn't ready to do. You see, on this night in January, and I remember, I think it was January 26th. This is how vividly I remember this night because it was the last night that I would live in my home and native land. If you are the last person in the world to know this, I am Canadian. Hi, nice to meet you. I must have never met you before in my life. That is okay. Most people that have known me for more than 5 minutes, it somehow seems to come up. But on this day, this would be the last day I would live in Canada. It would be this day that I said goodbye to a certain way of life, the life that I had always known. And it would be the last day that I would live anywhere close to my family. And even 7 years ago, I remember it crystal clear. After months of interviews and paperwork, health tests, and countless delays, I was finally permitted by the United States government to become a permanent resident of the U.S. We spent 2 days packing a U-Haul, preparing for the move. We emptied our apartment, we packed up our cats, and we were going to spend one last night at my parents' house before our lives were significantly altered. Now, for those that know me, you know that I give my family a very tough time. They tend to come up in my messages quite often. The only reason that happens is because I care for them. You understand that, right? Like, if I didn't love my family, if I had not had a close relationship with my family, there is no way that I would be talking as freely about them. In fact, most times that I bust, especially on my mom or dad, most times when I bust my parents' chops, they know about it in advance and they listen in just to see how badly I throw them under the bus. It's a very tight relationship. But despite my weird history, we are a very close family. I have 5 younger siblings, and two things I think really informed the closeness of our family. The first is my mom had the great idea to homeschool me. Shout out to my homeschool friends. And naturally, that kind of really amplifies the closeness of your family, or it drives you apart. One of the two. It's almost 50-50. But for us, it really knit us together. Especially the two brothers that are closest to me in age, we are super tight because we had to spend countless hours together cooped up in a little bedroom doing homeschooling together. I mean, it was real stuff. Like, we were super well-educated, but we spent a lot of time together. And the second thing was we moved a lot as kids. I had moved, and always a minimum of 90 minutes away. I moved when I was 4, I moved when I was 9, and I moved when I was 13. And nothing really, in my estimation, very few things bring you together with your family quite like having to start over. And so I became very, very close with my family. I'd never lived more than 90 minutes away. I went to school about 90 minutes away from home. My first pastor position was about 90 minutes, maybe a little more than that, away. I had never missed a holiday. I'd never missed a birthday or a graduation. And this night, after months of mental preparation, I realized that I hadn't prepared for this, that I wasn't ready, that I couldn't do this. And as embarrassing as it may seem and feel, and looking back, yeah, it's kind of embarrassing, I bawled. I sobbed. Because though I knew that God had uniquely called me to move to the southern tier of New York to be part of a church family there, even though He had compounded signs and used our delays. We were supposed to move in June or July, but it took 6-7 months longer than we anticipated. And He used those delays to set us up for long-term stability and success once we landed in Steuben County. I couldn't move past this. I couldn't leave my family. And so I laid in a futon in what used to be our homeschool room, actually. And I told my wife, I can't do this. I can't move. It was 831 miles from my parents' house to the church I was supposed to move to. And I knew what that meant. I knew that it meant missing significant milestones. I knew I wouldn't be home for Christmas or birthdays. I would likely miss graduations, and I may even miss funerals, and it broke me. Because I loved my family. And at that moment, I couldn't give them up. They were one of, if not the most important thing in my life. And I couldn't let them go. And my mind was racing to find a way, any way out. Somewhere in the middle of the night, I had a conversation with God. And I remember wrestling and begging and pleading and bartering, asking Him to fix this. And as much as I wish I could say, I had this big eureka moment where God spoke to me, which has happened, not audibly, but I have felt God speak to me in my spirit before. This wasn't one of those times. This was one of the times that I don't know that I've ever done this before, that I cried myself to sleep. I was just too exhausted to keep my eyes open, and so I fell asleep. And then I woke up. And I don't know where in that sleep I got the courage or the clarity or the understanding. But when I woke up, I had resolved in my heart that I couldn't not go where God called me. Several months earlier, I had heard a song by Audio Adrenaline. They're a Christian band from the 90s and the early 2000s. And they had a song called Hands and Feet that says, I want to be your hands, I want to be your feet, I'll go where you send me. And I remember hearing that song during this process and having this feeling that God was using this to remind me that I committed to go wherever He sent me. And I said I wouldn't back down now. So instead of allowing my love for my family to keep me from where God was leading, I chose to follow where Jesus sent me. With a broken heart and tear-stained face, I chose to do what he was calling me to do, no matter what. And in retrospect, it's a choice that I would make again and again and again, because God has been more than faithful to me, and I know that isn't going to stop. There's a conversation that Jesus has with one of his disciples, his disciple Peter, after Jesus' resurrection. And he asks him a series of questions. And each time when we think back to the story, what we tend to think of is just a simple, Peter, do you love me? But in John 21, verse 15, I realized that I had forgotten what Jesus actually asked Peter in his first question. You see, it wasn't just, do you love me? He said this. He said, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Jesus didn't just ask Peter if he loved him. He asked him if he loved Jesus more than those who were closest to him, because Peter had been with his disciples, with Jesus' disciples, the men who Peter had devoted his life to serve and to serve with, the men with whom Peter had spent every waking moment for over 3 years. And Jesus looks at these men and says, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? The question Jesus asks is no small matter. Its significance was not lost on Peter. And in that series of times when God confronted me on this matter, I, in my mind's eye, see Jesus looking at me and asking me the same question that he asked of Peter. Jesus looks at those whom I treasure the most and asks me, Jordan, do you love me more than these? And it's a question that's posed to each and every one of us, regardless of our context, regardless of our stage in life. It's a question that he asked me that cold Canadian night, even though I didn't realize it at the time. And it's a question that he often asks. We've been going through this series called Game of Thrones, and we've been identifying areas in our lives, kingdoms that lay claim to our heart. And we've been addressing how God is better and bigger and more powerful and more freeing than anything that would try to lay claim to the throne of our hearts. And the challenge for almost every single one of these, I would say every single one of these, the challenge is that these aren't inherently bad things. This could have been a whole series about all the bad things in the world that want your heart. And we could have pat ourselves on the back for the most part and been like, cool, I'm in a good place. But the challenge of this series for me, I know for me, and I know for many of you, haven't been because these are bad things that we know are bad, but these are good things, God-given things, that can so sneakily attempt to take the place of God without us even noticing it. Because it's so easy to get things askew. It's so easy to misprioritize. It's easy to allow the gift to take the place of the giver. Kyle Eidelman says it well when he says that the more beautiful a thing is, the more capacity it has to become an idol. The more I fear losing it, the more likely I am to worship it. Which is why it's so challenging when God asks us to examine the areas in our life that we guard. When he shines a light on the things that we'd rather not have him look at. Or when he asks us the question that he asked Peter, do you love me more than these? And here is where we face that question that I was faced with so many years ago, the question that many of us don't want to ask. And if we're good at connecting the dots, perhaps you know where I'm going with this and you're hoping to avoid it like the plague, but it's too important to avoid. It's too critical to not examine. Because perhaps more than any area in our lives, especially in the American Christian church, the idol of family is perhaps the most deceptive idol that we have to deal with. In large part because it is the most beautiful gift that God has given, and it is a gift that is closest to God's heart. But as we will discover, the gift that is closest to God's heart is also the one that can quite easily become an idol. And so Jesus looks to my family and to yours and asks the question, do you love me more than these? And this is tough because significant portions of Scripture center on the prominence of family, the importance of its defense, the high value that God places on the family unit. There are countless commands regarding conduct toward members of your family. Family is clearly important. So some of us will wonder, how can family become an idol, much less a deceptive one? Well, I think the problem that we face is that in our culture, there's one of two prominent ways of seeing family in America. The first is family as a prison, as a ball and chain. And we see family as the thing holding us back. We see family as the thing we need to be liberated from in order to achieve our hopes and dreams. That's not a particularly common way of seeing the family within the Christian church, but it's not unheard of. But the thing that we often in the church find is the opposite. The other view is the quite prominent one, and it is where we walk down the path toward idolatry when it comes to family. In this view, the family promises to give you everything you really wanted. It promises to fill a void in your heart. It promises to bring fulfillment and to bring peace and to bring hope. If you could only capture, especially this specific dream of that family, everything will be right. And this is the view that often is pervasive in American Christian culture. In many ways, the family has even become synonymous with Christianity. If you turn on Christian radio, you'll hear terms like family-friendly and family values that are essentially their code for Christian. Now, I think they do, a lot of these radio stations do that because they don't want to turn somebody off who isn't a Christian, but even non-church, anti-church people know the game. When they hear family-friendly, they know they're saying Christian. It's not really a hard code to break. The problem is, though, that when we equate family with Jesus, we conflate the two, and we assume any decision that we make for our family must be God-sanctioned. And the reality is that Jesus doesn't give us that out. Jesus is not giving us the out to say any decision I make that I think is good for my family is from God. According to Jesus, family is good, necessary, and foundational. But family cannot take the place of God. The good cannot take the place of the best. There's a couple of teachings of Jesus that operate along these lines. In Matthew chapter 10, when Jesus is sending his core followers out to do ministry on his behalf, he gives them a series of instructions, but then a series of warnings. He warns them that they will come under fire for service of Jesus, even from their own family, but their allegiance has to remain clear. Jesus had to come first. And so he tells them in Matthew 10, verse 37, he says, anyone who loves their father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who loves their son and daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Whoever does not take up their cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds their life will lose it. And whoever loses their life for my sake will find it. A parallel teaching in Luke 14 uses even stronger language. He says, if you want to be my disciple, you must, by comparison, hate everyone else. Your mother and father, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even your own life. Otherwise, you can't be my disciple. Kyle Eidelman, in his book, Gods at War, uses the mental picture of a bicycle wheel, which is hard for me to use this week because some of you know that I've been having some issues with my bike this week. Not great. But it's a good metaphor. He talks about that every spoke of the wheel represents a different and significant relationship that make up your life. One spoke represents your mother. One, perhaps your father. One spoke can be a sibling, your significant other. One spoke could be your child, and on it goes. And we tend to make God one spoke in the wheel. One important, yes, significant, yes, relationship, but just one of many. But God isn't interested in just being a spoke in the wheel of your life, maybe valued equally to your siblings, your significant other, your mother, father, or your children. But that's not Jesus' goal. He's not desiring to just be another spoke in the wheel. Jesus wants to be the central hub from which all spokes come to and from which all spokes connect. You see, God intends for us to love our children and our parents, our siblings, our spouses wholeheartedly, but only in the context of our foundational love for God. The problem isn't your love for your children. You can breathe a sigh of relief if you were worried. It isn't your love for your parents. It isn't your love for little old grandma. That's not the problem. It's when your love for these takes away your love for God. It's when your allegiance to these usurps your allegiance to God. It's when Jesus asks the question, "Do you love me more than these?" And the answer in your heart of hearts, in the core of your being, is no. And friends, this is a dangerous place for you to be, and not just for your sake, but for your family's sake. There's a couple of reasons why this is so dangerous and why this is so important. The first, I think, is because when you worship somebody in your family, you set them up with unrealistic expectations. Have you ever heard the term, he worships the ground she treads on? You ever heard that before? Somebody, at least, nod at me. That's something that I've heard. Now, typically, we say this about somebody that's completely devoted to their significant other. Usually, it's a man devoted to his spouse. Often, it's used as a positive. Oh, look at him. Doesn't he worship the ground she treads on? Their life revolves on this person. They're willing to do anything and everything to make them happy. Their significance is found in them. She is his whole world, and he completes her. And while this may sound phenomenal to have somebody worship the ground under your feet, to have somebody dedicate themselves to your happiness, it won't be long before your shoulders begin to droop under the weight of that responsibility. Maybe you feel like you have to live up to some certain expectations because of the image they see of you. So you pretend to be somebody that you're not because your significant other venerates not only you, but the dust beneath your feet. You can't have a bad day. You can't let your stress out. You can't rely on them to be there for you when you struggle or you hurt. And so you fracture the relationship because one worships the other instead of both worshiping God. You see, nobody other than God was meant to carry that weight. Nobody other than God was meant to carry the weight of your worship. Nobody was expected to be told, "I place all of my happiness and all of my significance on you." Nobody says that explicitly. But if you've ever been in that kind of relationship, you know what that's like. Who would want that? It's painful and damaging. And relationships like that are hard, if not impossible, to maintain. But let's turn to our children for a moment. I was a youth pastor for a decade, and I saw this time and time again. If the burden of a significant other seems to be overwhelming, imagine the impact it has on our children. You may have never considered that you worship your children. But many parents in their conduct, absolutely without question, venerate their children and hold them in a place that only God can hold. Maybe it's because the parent didn't have a great childhood. Maybe it's because they did not get to do the things that they wish they could. But I've seen far too many parents elevate their children and hold them to standards that they could never live up to. Whether it's because the child has athletic abilities that the parent never had, or musical or artistic skills that they could only dream of. Perhaps their academic achievements might result in an Ivy League scholarship that the parent never could have attended on their own. But their lives become centered on their children achieving what they never could. And the parent obsesses over them being the best, pushing them and pushing them and pushing them to succeed, even when the child would prefer not to. I heard a story of a phenomenal hockey player. Of course, I'm Canadian. It's going to be a hockey story. That went first overall in the NHL entry draft. So we're talking a young man who not only was good, but was really good. Like, best in his class. And you find out he comes into the league with all kinds of gusto and pomp and circumstance. And he comes in and he signs a record-breaking deal, which in the NHL was like $4 million, because the NHL is not huge. But he signs this huge deal, and he has all of these advertisements. And within 5 years, he's flamed out of the league. He stops playing hockey. And in an interview, he shares that he never wanted to play hockey in the first place. His family found early on that he was very talented. And so he recognized from a really young age that he had to do this because his parents were relying on it. And so they would drive him to the ice rink at 5 a.m. in the morning for practice. They'd buy him the best gear, which for hockey, that's expensive. What was he supposed to do? His parents were relying on him. If he didn't make it, what were they going to do? And so he spent his life, in fact, his story is kind of tragic, because even after leaving hockey, he realized it's all he could do. So even though he didn't like it and he didn't have any joy in it and he didn't want to do it, it's all he knew. So I think he's still playing hockey. And that's tragic. Because if I could counsel parents of one thing, this is the best case scenario if you allow yourself to live vicariously through your child. It's the best you can hope for is having a miserable child that only knows one thing that they hate. If I've met one kid that has gone to university that wasn't ready for it because their parents said they had to, and so now they're $75,000 into debt with a degree they don't want and never could have used, but they have a job anyways because mom was relying on it because she never went to university, even though she wished she could. If I met one child that dedicated their lives to playing some sport that they were pretty good at, but were never going to turn pro, but their parents were committed to this idea that they were going to make it big and they were going to have significance because I couldn't play hockey or I couldn't play basketball or I couldn't play soccer. And then you meet these kids that grow up feeling that they could never be good enough. They feel like they could never satisfy the longing and the desires of their parents, because even though their parents never realized it and maybe would never admit it, their parents turned their children into the source of their satisfaction and their source of happiness. And friends, that is idol. That is worship. That is taking your children and placing them in a position they were never meant to be, that God never wanted to see them in, and your children become miserable. Listen to your kids. I know that the world is pushing them to have a trillion extracurriculars. But at what cost? At what cost? That's great. It's fantastic. And if that's what they want, that's fine. don't elevate your kids to some unreasonable height that they can only fall from. When you put your child in the place of God, the burden is too much for them to carry. And when you sacrifice everything at the altar of family, somebody always gets hurt. So the question at this point is, now what? What's the solution? What do I do with this? Because if the answer is love my family less, I don't feel like that's a solution, right? So what? I think the answer isn't about loving your family less. It's loving your family differently. You see, the decision to make Jesus the center of your life is the most important decision you can make for the sake of your family, because it frees your family from being the source of your fulfillment and happiness. It frees you to love out of the overflow of God's love rather than loving that requires them to fulfill you. It allows you to love selflessly instead of selfishly. There's a story that's seldom told in the Hebrew scriptures that we call the Old Testament, that I think is appropriate here. 1 Samuel tells the story of, unsurprisingly, a man named Samuel. They didn't really name books cleverly back then. But 1 Samuel is the beginning of this story of this man's life, and begins not with his life, but a story of his parents. The first person we meet is a woman named Hannah. Hannah has, to this point, been unable to have children. Something heartbreaking for many women today, but a source of deep shame for women in her culture. So it's unsurprising that for years of torment, both internal and external, that Hannah finds herself in the house of the Lord at a place called Shiloh, apparently some distance from her home. Along with her husband Elkanah, they sacrificed to the Lord, and Elkanah's heart broke for Hannah, and he wanted to do nothing more than to ease her suffering. But in 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 10, Hannah is shown alone in the house of the Lord. And the author tells us, in her deep anguish, Hannah prayed to the Lord, weeping bitterly. And she made a vow, saying, Lord Almighty, if you only look on your servant's misery and remember me, and not forget your servant, but give her a son, then I will give him to the Lord for all his days, and no razor will ever be used on his head. A priest named Eli spots her, and after some confusion, we're told Eli thought Hannah was some drunk woman being dumb. That's an interesting thing. I am hoping I'll never make that mistake for you. But after he makes that mistake and she sets him right, she pours her heart out to him, and he tells her, go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant you what you have asked of him. And by this time next year, we see that Hannah conceived and had a son, and she named him Samuel, saying that because I asked the Lord for him. And the author tells us that in spite of her family going back to Shiloh, she tells her husband that she's going to stay home until the child was ready. And here's where I should pause and give some clarity to those who may not know where this story is going. If you have church knowledge, this story may sound familiar, as though she was going to dedicate her son at the temple and then bring him home. It's an awful lot like how we do infant baptisms or baby dedications in church. You bring your child and you bring him up front or her up front, and we'll either ceremonially baptize them, initiating them into the family of God, or we'll pray a prayer of consecration over, they usually would both in both baptism and dedication, we'll pray a prayer of consecration over your child. And then, of course, you'll get to take them home. But that's not what we're talking about here. When Hannah says that she will give her son to the Lord, it wasn't a symbolic gesture, but it was a literal one. She promised to bring her son to the house of the Lord and entrust him to God for his upbringing. And so once the child is ready, which many scholars believe to be about 3 years, Hannah readies herself to go to Shiloh to do what she said she would do, giving up the son whom she had birthed and nursed the one whose cries kept her up at night and whose beautiful face no doubt occupied her dreams. This beautiful boy was the child of promise, the child she had longed for, the child she had waited for. He was a miracle child, a gift from God, and now she had to entrust the gift to the giver. I believe that few parents can hear this story and remain unmoved. In stories, we often become the characters. We identify with them. And in this one, Hannah makes a choice that none of us want to make. We know what it's like to adore our children. Every child is a special, wonderful, miracle child. And most parents would give their lives without question for their children. Hannah's whole life had been wrapped up in this little Samuel for 3 years. So it was no small ask that she followed through on her promise. And unlike other biblical stories where the protagonist is asked to give up their child only to be allowed to keep that child, Hannah was not given that out. God asked her to entrust Samuel to him. And it would be understandable if this was too much to ask, right? You would probably not fault her if she made another choice. But her heart was settled. She would not place the weight of idolatry on her son. Hannah loved Samuel too much to withhold him from the promise she had made. And so she travels to Shiloh, and she offers her son, her only son, to God. 1 Samuel 2 tells us that she saw him once a year from then on, when she and Elkanah would travel to Shiloh for worship. And you even are told that every year she'd make him an outfit. Boy, if that doesn't make you want to cry. Hannah's story effectively ends in verse 21, though. And it says this. It says, "And the Lord was gracious to Hannah, and she gave birth to 3 sons and 2 daughters. And meanwhile, the boy Samuel grew up in the presence of the Lord." Because Hannah oriented her life on God, on being faithful to his call, because her allegiance was to him, even when it hurt, because she chose to trust that God would keep and protect her son, that God would use him more than she could imagine, and even to trust that God would bless her faithfulness to him. Because of all of this, God blessed her fivefold. Had Hannah selfishly held Samuel back from God, who knows what the results would have been? What we can know is that her place in the story of God's faithfulness would have been significantly altered. We probably wouldn't even know of her. Samuel would play a significant role in the life of God's people. God used him beyond anything I think she'd ever hoped or imagined. But none of it would have been possible without surrender. None of it would have been possible if Samuel sat in the place of God in Hannah's heart. And that's the challenge that we face. Are we willing to entrust our family to God? To do what only God could do? To allow him to protect in a way that only God can? Because for some of us, the problem is that we are obsessed with worry and fear for our children. But God is asking us to trust in him, to be faithful to him, and to allow him to do what helicopter parenting will never accomplish. One thing that my mother and father have at least recognized, because they were kind of helicopter parents for me, and they're, my family has gone in wildly different directions in the course of their life. It's too long to really get into, but if you know me, you know the variety of different outcomes. But I think they've come to the realization that they tried too hard to protect me from things that God wanted me to experience. Because they were so obsessed with this idea of the life that I was supposed to have. But what they have come to discover is that what they needed to do first and foremost was trust that God was enough. Is to dedicate and to entrust us to God and to surrender us to him. And the question that we have to face, that is demanded on us to answer, is, are we willing to surrender our families to God to allow him to have the rightful place as the hub of our lives and free ourselves to love out of his overflow? It's only in this surrender that we will find true freedom. It's only in this surrender that we will find the margins to train up our children in the way they should go. It's only in this surrender that we will ensure that our parents don't have undue influence on us, or that we will not make a decision that is detrimental to our walk with Christ for the sake of our husbands or wives. It's the way that we can say to our children, I love you too much to make you the center of my life. In the words of Jesus, it is the choice to say that I will lose my life for Jesus' sake so that I can find it. I don't know where you find yourself at, whether you are like me, you don't have any children, but your relationship with your family is so intertwined that you can't see yourself decoupling from that at any cost. And maybe that has even become a barrier between you and God. Maybe you have kids, and maybe you struggle to entrust them to God, and you try to control their lives, and you maybe have found yourself in the portrait I painted earlier, and you're realizing that instead of doing what is best for them, you're actually damaging not just their lives, but your relationship with them. Maybe it's a continuation of last week as we discussed about romance. Maybe it's your significant other and you have placed all of your happiness and all of your fulfillment in the basket of that person. And maybe you know what that's like to carry that responsibility on your shoulders, or maybe you're just now realizing the weight that you're placing on them. My hope for you is that you would find freedom in surrender. That you would find freedom in making Jesus the center of your life and allowing everything else to fall properly into place. To allow your family to have the freedom from carrying the burden of your worship. I'm going to ask if the worship team would come back up. We're going to close in a song together that is a particularly hard one to sing in light of what we're talking about. It's called Take My Life. And the song says, take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee. And the chorus of this song is perhaps the hardest one, because it says, here I am, all of me, take my life, it's all for thee. And in light of this message, in light of this discussion, it is, for some of us, going to be incredibly difficult to respond with anything at all. It may be that you are wrestling and you are pushing, maybe you're even pushing back, and you're saying, nope, this is not me. I am not dealing with this. I'm actually going to give you an out because I don't want you to rush into saying, yep, I'll do it. In fact, in Luke, in that passage where Jesus said, you must comparatively hate your family compared to your love for me, he says, you must count the cost. So I want to give you an out to be able to say, I'm not ready to make that commitment yet. This is a huge ask, and Jesus understands that. So what I'd ask throughout this, maybe God's been working on you and you're ready to do that. I want to challenge you in the form of whether it's a posture of surrender by coming forward and kneeling or standing or sitting, kneeling where you're at. Maybe it's just a posture of your heart.
Maybe it's standing and lifting your hands in surrender to God. I challenge you to make that decision, but if you're not there, my challenge to you is not just to walk away. Don't just say, nope, no, I'm done. There is beauty in the tension. And God is big enough to wrestle with you. And he is not put off by it. So wherever you're at, I want to give you the freedom and the margins to wrestle, to argue back, to push back if you have to, but don't disengage. Be willing to have this discussion with God, because it could be the most important decision you ever make for the sake of your family. So I'd invite you to join us in singing. You can stand if you would like. You can sit. You can kneel. You can come forward and pray. However you feel best reflects the posture of your heart as we sing.